Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, Trump giving our NATO allies some indigestion at breakfast yesterday. It seems to me that Trump really likes to seize on a combination of two things. There's sort of two sides of the same coin. One is weakness of adversaries. Mm-hmm. And I know these are allies, our NATO allies, but they're also adversaries in a lot of meaningful ways. Thus, some of the tariff policy that's gone back and forth among some of our NATO allies. Thus, the very public disagreement about how to handle refugees and the discussion of immigration more in the West more generally. I think so there's the weakness of adversaries and also the success of strategies that are employed against adversaries. And I think Trump has found some success exhibiting American hegemony in these meetings, making sure it's clear to everybody who is the big dog on the block and who will be doing the dictating.
To me, it's all about he's sick of picking up the check. You know, there comes a point of time of fatigue where you're just sick of paying for everything. And that's what he wants. He wants our NATO allies to pay up, to pay their fair share of defense.
But it was interesting that he focused specifically on Germany. There's a couple of legitimate reasons for it. But here's some of Trump's remarks that had his chief of staff, John Kelly, squirming in his seat.
When Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia, where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia. So we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting all of these countries. And then numerous of the countries go out and make a pipeline deal with Russia, where they're paying billions of dollars into the coffers of Russia. So we're supposed to protect you against Russia, but they're paying billions of dollars to Russia, and I think that's very inappropriate. And the former chancellor of Germany is the head of the pipeline company that's supplying the gas.
Yeah.
It sounds very Chicago-esque.
Well, it does a little bit, and Trump sounds like very watchdogian in exposing this and openly complaining about it. There's some historical precedent on this, too. Back in 1982, President Reagan blew up a pipeline that our allies, and I mean, who had a close relationship to England than when Reagan was president and Thatcher was prime minister? The Thatcher government wanted a pipeline from the Soviet Union to Western Europe. Reagan wanted to punish the Soviet Union for its repressive actions in Poland, as well as prevent Western European dependency on Russian energy, which is what Trump is talking about here with the Germans. He issued sanctions against companies doing business with the pipelines. And then the pipeline in 1882 went boom. The U.S. government at the time learned the Soviets were looking to steal American software to operate the pipelines, and so the Reagan administration booby-trapped the software and blew up the pipeline. So, you know, playing hardball with NATO allies is not new. I think what's a little bit new is the rhetoric that Trump employs.
And just so you know, the reason why John Kelly looked a little disturbed, it wasn't because of what Trump was saying. It was because he didn't get a real breakfast. He just got a croissant and cheese.
Doesn't like continental breakfast.
No, he doesn't. He wanted an American breakfast. He wanted eggs and bacon, meat, potatoes. That's what he wanted.
So yeah, that's what Sarah Sanders said.
He's kind of
said.
Squirming in his seat a little bit.
I'm not sure that I believe that.
And was that Kay Bailey Hutchinson sitting next to them?
Mm-hmm.
She's back. What is she? Because she's a senator ambassador in Texas. Oh, yes. That's what I figured when I had to look it up. But, yeah.
The interesting piece, too, sort of along the lines of what I'm saying, from Aaron Blake in the Washington Post, he describes what Trump's, the method of Trump's madness. He essentially calls it the madman approach to foreign policy, projecting unpredictability, which of course, President Trump likes to do. And he makes the point, it's pretty clear what's at play here. Trump has long expressed concerns about how much European countries are contributing to the common defense, that is NATO. And this is an American concern that predates his presidency.
Well, they said yesterday they're going to raise their defense spending from 2% to 4%.
No, that's what President Trump wants. He wants it to go to 4% of GDP. Nobody's there, including the United States at this point. But there has been an increase in contributions to the common defense by some of our allies after Trump started beating this drum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's difficult to argue against that. Even people who are critical of Trump's rhetoric, sometimes skeptical of his approach, like David French over at National Review, writes, President Trump, absolutely positively right to be upset at the state of the German military. It's indefensibly weak and unprepared. NATO isn't a social club. It's a military alliance. And even if one posits that Germany shouldn't reach its full potential military strength, see World War II, can't we at least ask that it not be a pale shadow of its recent West German past? All fair points, in addition to the thing that really seemed to get Trump riled, sort of extra riled than he was previously about contributions to the common defense, this pipeline from Russia. And it was a nice little bit of flipping the script. Oh, I'm, you know, Putin's best friend. Mm-hmm. I'm not the one cutting a pipeline deal with the Russians or trying to.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Brett Kavanaugh still making the rounds, feeding the homeless yesterday.
Oh, yeah. How dare he? Well, I know, the left was like, did you see? He's feeding the homeless. Well, yeah, he's scheduled to do that long before he was a nominee for the Supreme Court justice.
Mm-hmm. And then this...
There's such a big deal about it.
Trying to come up with anything that could hold up his nomination. Washington Post reporting that in 2016, Brett Kavanaugh reported having between $60,000 and $200,000 in debt, accrued over 3 credit cards and a loan. Isn't it fascinating? Each credit card held between $15,000 and $50,000 in debt, and a thrift savings plan loan was between $15,000 and $50,000 in debt. The debt was built up,
according
to White House spokesman Rod Shaw.
Gambling habit?
Because of buying Washington National season tickets and tickets for playoff games for himself and a handful of friends. Also, some of the debts were for home improvements.
Well, yeah, obviously the larger ones. But people don't realize season tickets cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And when I had my season tickets, you put it on your credit card, and then you slowly paid it off throughout the year. That's what people – you've got season tickets.
This is riveting.
You know how it works. That's all.
Kavanaugh's friends – wait, this
– wait, is baseball bad? 312-642-5600.
The story gets even more fascinating. Kavanaugh's friends reimbursed him for their share of the baseball tickets, and he's since stopped purchasing baseball tickets.
Because he's too busy coaching his daughter's team, right?
His most recent financial disclosure forms reveal reportable assets between $15,000 and $65,000, which would put him at the bottom of financial ranking of justices. Value of residence is not subject to disclosure, according to Shaw. The Kavanaughs have no debt at this juncture beyond their home mortgage, singular. He said the Kavanaughs has assets of nearly $1 million between the equity in his home and his retirement account. So, you know, he's been in the public sector for the last two decades. He hasn't been working as a private lawyer, so
right.
He doesn't have a lot of, he doesn't have significant, I mean, doesn't have a eye-popping net worth, I guess
right,
I would say.
Right, and has a mortgage, not mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine.
Yeah.
And I'm sure his home is worth probably $1 million, which is normal for Washington, D.C.
No, I don't think so. It's his total assets.
Total assets.
Yeah. But so that's the financial picture of Brett Kavanaugh.
But, I mean, they acted like it was a breaking news story yesterday.
Yeah. That's
like, credit card debt in the tens of thousands.
So,
and I just went and then looked into it. It's baseball tickets and home improvement.
He's not going to be compromised on the court by Visa or MasterCard. So don't worry, American electorate. The Washington Post is on it. This was sort of interesting, too, these dueling letters. You had classmates of his from Georgetown Prep, high school, who wrote a letter endorsing their classmate. Brett's defining characteristics in high school were his sharp intellectual ability, affable nature, and a practical and fair approach devoid of partisan purpose. It's a pretty advanced characterization for a high school kid these classmates are making. The letter continues the same traits that made him stand out at Georgetown Prep, distinguish him on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He's a devoted son, husband, father, and friend, despite his great achievements, he remains the same grounded and approachable person that we met in high school. They continue to advocate for his confirmation. Now that's very different than what's happening at Yale Law School, which is sort of a sign of the times, particularly on college campuses. Open letter signed by a host of Yale Law School students, alumni, and educators decrying Yale issuing a press release celebrating a Yale Law graduate being nominated to the court and suggesting that, quote, Judge Kavanaugh's nomination presents an emergency, an emergency for democratic life, for our safety and freedom, and the future of our country. Yale students, Yale Law students, alumni, and educators, professors. An emergency for democratic life, our safety and freedom, and the future of the country, does one Brett Kavanaugh present.
How do they warp safety into this?
People will die if he is confirmed, Amy. We don't have time to make an evidentiary case. It's an emergency.
They should be celebrating him, the fact that they had walked in the same halls as him, sat in the same lecture halls as him.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe he might have touched the same books.
Excuse me, he's a monster.
This is my favorite. What Kavanaugh was secretly caught doing hours after Trump's nomination will silence his critics.
He's a monster who must be stopped.
He's feeding the homeless. Shame on him.
As David French writes in National Review, to read this Yale letter is to peer into the future. Young lawyers, students already on a trajectory to lead the American Academy, government, economy. They represent a left-wing face of American intolerance. That's redundant. And he suggests if you think polarization is bad now, the radical students at Yale are sending a clear message. They have not yet begun to rage. No question about it.
Rage all you want. I'm not listening. It's like white noise, you know?
Well, it is, except to the extent that you've got people that are in positions of authority now. You're talking about, you know, late Yale law students are influencers now, and you've got the next crop coming online. God and Man at Yale, that was Bill Buckley's famous book. There's certainly not God, and there are too many men at Yale these days. Tom in Deer Park, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. Hey, Dan, the culture has come a long way. I was wondering if you could explain to the class why Doug Ginsburg was rejected in, I think it was 86 or 87.
It gave us
when
Kennedy.
Reagan appointed him.
Yeah. That gave us Kennedy.
I'll hang up.
It was because he admitted to smoking marijuana. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that did him in. I mean, I don't think that would, even if he got vetted for that now, I don't think that would happen. So I think we've come a long way. That's my point.
Oh, okay. Thanks for the call, Tom.
Well, yeah. Because marijuana is legal in some states now?
I don't know that we've come a long way. I mean, you know, we're about to put somebody on the high court. who amassed thousands of dollars in temporary debt for buying baseball tickets.
And his friends reimbursed him. This is great. So how this story broke that he was feeding the homeless. I don't know why I'm fascinated with this. He always donates his time to Catholic charities. And a woman was walking home from work and saw him outside of this parish working with Catholic charities. And she snapped the picture and she was shocked that he would be there without protection and sent it to the Daily Caller.
Okay.
It's gripping. I mean, the way he handles the plate and puts the food on the plate and interacts with the homeless.
Yeah, this guy is...
he's dangerous.
There's no question. Also, this piece in The Atlantic from a gentleman named Paul Rosenzweig, who's a think tank guy now, but he was an attorney who appeared before Kavanaugh when he was on the D.C. Court of Appeals. And it's interesting. He talks about a case in where an inmate that he was representing, this lawyer was representing, wanted to appeal his conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what happened is there was a notice of intent to appeal that was made. The appeal needs to be filed in a certain period of time. Otherwise, you lose your standing to appeal. And there was some snafu within the U.S. Bureau of Prisons of getting the paperwork to the D.C. Court of Appeals so that his appeal could be heard on the merits. And by the, you know, kind of black letter of the time restriction, Kavanaugh could have easily just said, well, we're not going to hear the appeal. You missed the deadline. But rather than that, the essence of what Kavanaugh said, according to Rosenzweig, give me a hard and fast rule and I'll apply it, but here I have discretion. Why shouldn't we let him, the prisoner who was seeking to appeal his conviction, have the appeal and turn to the merits of the appeal in making our decision? And that's what happened, writes Rosenzweig. Exercising their discretion, the judge and the panel decided that enough had been done to make my client's appeal effective, and they agreed to hear the merits of the case. He lost on the merits, but at least he had the satisfaction of having his day in court. The Kavanaugh I know is likely to be reluctant to find discretion in the law. He will see in hard and fast rules that bind him. But where he does see discretion, at least in one instance, he was generous and open to the appeal, of the little guy, and that, in the end, isn't a bad way to be. Greg and Schomburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Good.
Okay, Amy, this one is for you.
Okay.
We will know that we have a problem with this candidate for the Supreme Court when CNN breaks bad on his wife for bringing a bad snack to the basketball game.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for the call, Greg. Yeah.
It's true. It's all about the snacks.
Jeff and Berwyn.
Greetings, Dan and Amy. With all the hysteria and histrionics that these snowflakes and SJWs are doing for what is relatively a mild, mainstream kind of judge, what are they going to do when Ginsburg croaks? Because it's going to be sooner rather than later. It's certainly going to be within the 6.5 years that Trump is going to be president. What rabbit are they going to be able to pull out of their hat after what they're doing here to Kavanaugh? It's kind of a rhetorical question, but... Do you get my point?
Yeah, totally. Thanks.
They're going nuts over a relatively mild fellow, and when she gets replaced, they're going to have a 6-3 permanent majority, and even Breyer might get replaced because he's 81.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, heads will pop off. There's no question. Thanks for the call, Jeff.
But RBG, we pray for her every Sunday in church. She's on our prayer list.
Good for you.
I'm just saying she's on the sheet. I'll bring it in for you.
No, thank you, Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Hey, this is bad news for Eddie Ford of Barrington Hills. He can never be appointed to the Supreme Court because in the early 90s, he bought season tickets for the White Sox, and I paid cash for my 20 games. And I don't know if he ever reported it to the IRS, so they'll be digging in on him next. What is this BS with Kavanaugh? Don't they know if they knock him out, they knock out 4 Democratic senators, and then when Trump has 56 Republican senators, they'll put someone even more conservative? What are they going to do next about Kavanaugh? They're going to go over his reading material? Because as a teenager, he checked out Death of a Salesman, so that means sloth. He checked out Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. That means he likes to use the N-word. and he checked out one of the most offensive books of all time,
what?
The Bible. Mm-hmm. Because even in the New Testament, where it says to give your money to the poor, it doesn't say anything about giving it to the government first and let them siphon most of it off. So that means he doesn't back socialism.
Thanks, Mike.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. A tragedy in Chicago yesterday. An Irishman lost his job in county government. And that's something that we have to remark upon because it's never happened before.
No.
Cook County Forest Preserve police officer Patrick Connor. He gone.
Yeah, and it was on the eve of a hearing where he was going to explain himself to the Internal Affairs Disciplinary Hearing Board to explain, you know, why he didn't do anything, why he was standing around kind of dragging his feet when a 24-year-old woman was wearing a Puerto Rican T-shirt at the Forest Preserve,
you know, uh-huh.
That's where he, and she was confronted by a pretty, I'd say he was drunk, maybe we could use the word allegedly drunk man, who didn't like her T-shirt and didn't think she was being patriotic.
Officer, can you please, I'm renting this area, and he's harassing me about the shirt that I'm wearing.
It was her 24th birthday party, and as this man approached the woman behind the cell phone camera, she started rolling.
You should not be wearing that in the United States of America.
Okay.
Are you a citizen?
Yes, I am a
citizen. Are you
a United
States citizen?
Can you please get away from me?
Then you should not be
Can
wearing
you please get
that.
Away from me?
You should be wearing the United States
officer,
of America.
Officer, I feel not highly uncomfortable.
So do I.
Grab him.
I feel highly uncomfortable too, officer.
Well, it was 6 minutes, and then snaps of it were broken down and put onto social media, and eventually 3 million people have viewed this.
Right.
And it caught the governor of Puerto Rico's attention, and he was demanding that this officer be fired. Tony Preckwinkle, our Cook County Board President, valiantly picked up the phone, called the governor of Puerto Rico to apologize.
And
it became an international scandal.
So has Officer Connor awakened yet? Is he what was he doing during that when that woman petitioned him for a little help?
Well, he was standing with his hands underneath his bulletproof vest. This you can see his gun is there, you know, holstered properly.
Sure.
Kind of walking around. I mean, literally, I watched all 36 minutes of it, and he's kind of circling. He goes in frame, then he goes out of frame. And he's kind of hanging around the guy as if they know each other. As if he's a frequent visitor of the Forest Preserve.
Was he able to use his words and communicate anything to the woman who asked him for help?
No, he wasn't speaking much at all.
Hmm.
If I don't even think I heard him speak. That's a good question. But then you see him, he's like a turtle, shoulders down, kind of moving in and out. But at the end, when other officers arrive.
Sure, this calls for reinforcements. I need backup here.
It's so, 'cause there's nobody else around.
I mean, the field is
empty. Nobody else is in the pavilion.
I got an elderly crank who's yelling at a woman about her T-shirt. I don't know what to do.
Help me. But maybe he didn't know what to do. Maybe he didn't have the proper training. And that's what one of the commissioners.
Are you out of your mind?
Chewy Garcia claimed the same thing that I said, that we need to properly train these Cook County Forest Preserve police officers so that they know what to do when a situation like this arises.
Yeah, it's a baffling situation. I mean, seriously, what could he have done? There's nothing.
What should
he
have done?
There's nothing he could have done.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I can't think of anything he could have done. Can you?
Yes, I could think of a lot of things he could have done.
What? I have no idea.
But before I get to that, just so you know how it ends, after 36 minutes, I watched it so you don't have to. Eventually, after help arrives, he does sit down with the drunk guy and takes a statement from him. So he did do something, and even his police union said, wait, you haven't looked at the whole tape. This is just a snippet of what happened. He, you know, he's got a right to due process. But last night he called it quits, and now he's not going to be interviewed.
Too much pressure in that job. That's a pressure cooker. Cook County Forest Preserve Police.
All they do is, I mean, pretty go around and check to make sure people have permits to use pavilions.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, because sometimes people want the same pavilion, so they think it's first come, first serve, but you've got to apply for that permit earlier in the year.
Thank you for that.
That's what they do.
This is great. You should be a PIO for Cook County government. It's fascinating. So here's the thing. When does he get appointed to be one of those $80,000 a year picnic table inspectors?
Oh.
He can't really be without a job. He's just got to be reassigned to another sinecure, right?
That's how much money they make? Picnic table inspectors?
Yeah. You think those picnic tables inspect themselves? You could have a tragic picnic table accident. People could die, Amy. These are public safety professionals.
What he should have done.
Why did he quit? What did he say in a statement? Is he able to communicate? Written word.
All we know is according to the union lawyer.
Anything.
The union lawyer says that Connor has been, quote unquote, very stressed in the wake of this viral video.
Yeah.
But he was eager to cooperate with investigators and get the whole story out there, but then decided at the last minute to just resign.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Spend more time with his family.
He has a decorated career.
Decorated? At the Forest Preserve, does he?
He's been on the force without incident for 10 years. So he's done it.
Could you offer?
Dedicated a decade of his life to this calling.
Oh, good. I'm glad he vested for a pension. Thank goodness. Can you just run us through some of his career highlights?
He's been a union member for 10 years.
Yes.
No prior incidents. There you go.
No
prior incidents. My guy's got a clean record.
Boy, that's going to be a heck of a retirement party they throw
his,
him. I remember year one when he didn't have any incidents, and then year two and year three. Yeah, that's quite a string of accomplishments that he's put together.
But people still want, they think that he should have been fired. Now, is his pension since he resigned, is his pension safe, Dan? Right? If you resign from your job, are you okay?
Yeah.
Even if you're fired, can you still vest
after, I assume it's the same as, I think it's 10 years. So you vest after 10 years. So, yes, for people that are worried about the Cook County Forest Preserve police officer's pension, people that want to make sure that an Irishman doesn't lose his pension in the city of Chicago, that somebody who had a decorated career of 10 years of doing nothing without incident doesn't lose his seven-figure guaranteed pension, those people, please, let me allay your fears. That pension is safe. It's not funded.
No.
But it's safe on paper.
As for the person, Tribus, who apparently, you know, they're deciding whether or not to charge him with a hate crime. She said, I mean, there was no, he didn't touch her, but he's been charged with a felony for what? I mean, she said that he pointed his finger in her face. What he did was wrong, and it was stupid, and clearly Puerto Ricans are Americans. Duh, he didn't know that. He even, when in his drunk rant, he said, you can't even vote for president. But they can in the primary if you live on the island. Mm-hmm. If you live here, you can vote in the primary and the general election.
Well, you can do some tutorial with Tribus on your free time. Let's talk at the level that our audience understands the world, not the Cook County Forest Preserve police officer and this knucklehead that was accosting this woman. I'd like to get a count, dollar figure, and as well as just a personnel count. How many people ultimately were involved in this case? How much time was spent? How much money spent?
Well, I don't know how much time. I mean, after 10 days after it happened, before the video went viral, he was assigned to desk duty.
Sure.
So then somebody had to take his shift out on the beat.
Yeah.
Out on the floor. And there's three other officers that came for backup to help out.
That was a four-person incident, is what you're saying. We need four officers.
Mode of transportation was bike, so
right.
He wasn't going to.
We've got an old racist crank on a bike who's making fun of a woman's T-shirt. That's a four officer call.
I didn't even know. That's why
somebody
it took
call
so long.
The president. Call Cook County President Preckwinkle. We got to loop her in this crisis that we got at the Forest Preserve. Again, what could have been done?
He could have just said to the drunk guy, hey, back off. She rented the space. She has a permit. Just go away. Hit the road, buddy. Just leave. But he didn't, because I think there's a relationship there. I think they might be friends.
Mm-hmm.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line.
Dan in Libertyville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, I got to call you up, man. What's about this bigotry of the Irishman?
Yeah.
You keep saying he's an Irishman. Would you say that against a Muslim or
African
American?
I don't like,
what's up with that?
I don't like the Irish.
You don't like us mixed?
No.
You don't like us mixed?
No.
You are Irish, I bet.
We'll settle this, huh? We'll do like the old Notre Dame. Take care of it.
Thanks for the call, Dan. Yeah. No,
I think you're Irish.
Yeah, but you know how I hate white people.
I know.
Especially the Irish that have, run Chicago.
Yeah.
All their idiot cousins like Patrick Connor, who get no-show jobs at the Cook County Forest Preserve, where they can't adjudicate a conversation between.
But he's giving Chicago yet another black eye on an international
stage. Oh, my
God.
So, yeah.
Hey, when you have a whole island against you demanding that you be, I'm sure he's going to get death threats soon.
Yeah. Louis Gutierrez hasn't given Chicago a black eye.
Oh, no.
But it's this, do-nothing doofus who, was just another flunky on the Cook County government payroll. He's the real problem in Chicago. It's not a leadership-level problem. It's a flunky problem. It's idiot nephews. That's the real problem in Chicago. Longshanks drop from Braveheart.
Oh.
The Irish.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Some call me the sage from South Central. Others call me the czar of common sense. But you can call me Larry Elder. And you're invited to join me tonight starting at 7 right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, Brett Kavanaugh is President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, of course, and I think we should get these hearings scheduled and get that confirmation vote going post-haste.
Yeah, did you hear what he was doing yesterday? He was helping the homeless, something that he always does, and it was scheduled long before he was nominated to the Supreme Court.
That is the kind of activity
that
has him properly characterized as a threat to our very way of life in this country. That's not me saying that. That's Yale law students, alumni, professors. Judge Kavanaugh's nomination presents an emergency for democratic life, small d, for our safety and freedom. I'm scared for the future of our country. Kavanaugh is a menace. Yale's celebration of his achievements is motivated by nothing more than its lust for proximity to power and prestige, they continue. We've got a real crisis on our hands, as evidenced by that activity that you mentioned.
Scandalous.
Properly characterized by the best and brightest that Yale has to offer. In addition, we have now learned that in 2016... Brett Kavanaugh bought a bunch of baseball tickets to Washington Nationals games. I don't know how this guy lives with himself.
I mean, and then he paid off his credit cards, too. And his friends that he bought tickets for paid him back.
That's a fascinating story of intrigue.
If this is all they have on him, there's no there.
Well, I mean, look, what if Bryce Harper is involved in a case before the high court? Then Judge Kavanaugh will have to recuse himself. We can't have that, can we? For expert legal insight on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend, former U.S. Attorney General of the United States, former counsel to the president, and now the dean of Belmont University School of Law in Nashville. Also, his latest book, True Faith and Allegiance, True Faith and Allegiance. He is Alberto Gonzalez. Alberto Gonzalez, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. And I'm also a big baseball fan,
I
admire what Brett Kavanaugh did. That's a good thing.
Is that why you were not nominated to the high court? Your fandom of the Nationals?
I'm not a fandom of them. I grew up in Houston. So
oh,
I'm a big Houston Astros fan.
Oh well, best team in baseball, right there. What about Brett Kavanaugh? I assume you had interaction with him during your time at the White House when he was at the White House.
Sure, he worked for me for 2.5 years, so I got to know Brett quite well, and I have to applaud President Trump. I think he's made an excellent choice, and I think over time, people are going to see that, you know, Brett is going to be fair and open-minded in all these cases. He's very smart, but not arrogant. I've yet to meet anybody who has spent significant time with Brett, even people that work for him, who isn't doesn't respect him with a just a very genuine person. And so we all enjoyed working with him. He was a great colleague in the White House, and I think he'll do a good job on the court.
Do you think he has any moderate tendencies? I mean, I've been hearing that he's a conservative, but may become a moderate once he is sworn in. Is that?
I don't know what that means. You know, people think of. Describe that what they're saying or they're worried about is whether or not on various social issues will he not support their views on where the court should go on social issues. I think Brett's just going to try the very best to be totally objective, and whatever the text of the Constitution, he's going to look carefully at precedents and look carefully at the text of statutes. He has always impressed me as someone who believes strongly in judicial restraint, understanding that there are just some issues the courts have no business weighing in on, that should be rightly left to the elected branches who are accountable to the people. So I just, whether I don't know how what that means, moderate tendencies. I think Brett's going to be fair and open-minded, and I think that's all we can expect of a justice on the Supreme Court.
Just a little bit more of, since you've had so much personal experience with him, just if you could color in your interactions with him a little bit more, the kind of person he is, how he treated colleagues. I know, of course, he met his wife during his time at the Bush White House, too. So, I mean, just sort of, him as a three-dimensional human being, not just a guy in a black robe.
Right. Well, he has a good sense of humor. He loves sports. There were times when I would take Brett and some of the other lawyers out to play golf at Andrews Air Force Base. We did that from time to time. So he's a good athlete and obviously still coaches with his daughter's team, basketball teams. But as I said, he's just very thoughtful, no snap judgments, a good listener. I led a team of superstar lawyers. I think we had like 12 lawyers, 8 of them or so, clerked in the U.S. Supreme Court. These were all, this was a superstar team of lawyers. And I think, Brett was very well respected by this team. He and another lawyer, Brad Berenson, were probably the most senior. And so I think the other lawyers kind of looked to them. And, for example, Brad and Brett were responsible for setting up the process we put in place to examine judges and recommend judges, including the Supreme Court, to President Bush. I've got nothing but good things to say about Brett Kavanaugh. I think he's just going to do a superb job on the court.
And if confirmed, he would make history because then you'd have two former clerks from the same justice serving on the court together, that being Justice Kennedy. Do you think he'll sail through these confirmation hearings?
No, I don't. I think it's going to be a difficult process. I think, Brett, having worked in the White House and having worked to get judges confirmed, not Supreme Court judges, but other circuit court judges and district court judges. Brett understands the process extremely well, and I think that's going to benefit him. He knows what he's going to have to go through. It's not going to be fair, but it is part of the process. I think he appreciates how pivotal this seat is viewed by many in America. So I think it'll be tough, and there'll be questions and allegations, accusations that'll be totally untrue and unfair, but Brett understands that. I think he's prepared his family for that, and they'll get through it. It's a tough process, and it should be tough. I mean, this is a lifetime appointment, and this is for a pivotal seat. So I would expect the members of the Senate to do their job and to carefully scrutinize this nominee. But I'm very hopeful, that it's going to be as fair as we might expect it. And but at the end of the day, given his qualifications and given what I know about him as a person, I expect him to be confirmed.
How do you react to, the demagoguery of this letter penned by Yale law students and alumni and professors in opposition to Kavanaugh, an emergency to our very way of life in this country? I guess Elena Kagan, who hired Brett Kavanaugh to teach at Harvard Law also present such an emergency. I had no idea. But I mean, just in terms of the confirmation process, the scrutiny, it's not really scrutiny. It's just a bunch of politicians taking opportunity to demagogue from one perspective or another. And so, you know, how much of that really is productive for the American people in terms of inspiring confidence in the court and its members?
Well, that is a danger. I think that I was asked a few days ago about whether or not am I fearful that the court has become sort of more partisan and viewed as a political institution. And my response was I have more concern that the American people view it as such. And the kind of rhetoric that we're seeing today obviously contributes to that perception. And I think that's unfortunate. I respect law students, but there's a lack of maturity sometimes in the things that are said, and even with respect to law professors who I deal with day to day. And everyone has a right to speak their opinion. I'd like to hope that they would those opinions would be based upon fact and not intended to spread fear. But again, as I said earlier, I think as long as Brett receives a fair hearing, and there will be unfair accusations and allegations made against him, but based on what I know, he's going to be confirmed.
The Federalist Society. Federalist Society is now being targeted by the left and mischaracterized by the left because it's exhibited success. And as David Brooks said in a column over the weekend and on PBS NewsHour, you know, they've done the hard work of putting together talented people who exhibit professional excellence over the last 35 years. And those individuals like Brett Kavanaugh are the fruits of that labor. And I wonder, Leonard Leo, who's kind of been President Trump's point man on the Supreme Court nominations, on leave from the Federalist Society, you know, his Catholicism has been brought into question, much like Amy Coney Barrett's was by DiFi during her confirmation. So it's not just kind of the political rhetoric. You're also getting into real barbs directed at organizations and individuals based on their faith as well. That seems to be ratcheting up, and I wonder if you had any comment on that.
Yeah, I think that that is unfair. I think also, I dealt with Leonard when I was in the White House in the Federalist Society and obviously sought their input. But at the end of the day, I think Neil Gorsuch, if we had been in the White House and I was the White House counsel looking at two vacancies, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh would have been our selections as well, irrespective of any list, irrespective of any recommendation from the Federalist Society. So I don't know about spending energy in attacking organizations like the Federalist Society for these picks. At the end of the day, I would worry more about the nominees than the actual process of how these nominees were chosen or recommended to the President of the United States. The White House consults and should consult with a wide variety of groups, organizations, people about these nominees, and President Trump decided this is a process he wanted to use, and I think in a way, there are a lot of reasons why it was a good process. But also, when you put people on a list, it immediately puts a bullseye on them, and it immediately gives opponents opportunity and time to dig up dirt, to formulate a game plan to attack them in the event that they are nominated. So, people, I think, have viewed Brett Kavanaugh as a very serious contender ever since his name appeared on the list, and I'm sure they've been preparing for this. And that is the danger of doing something like a list. But from my perspective, what's really important at the end of the day is the nominee, not so much the process in which that nominee was discovered and recommended to the president.
Yeah, I mean, look, Tom Hardiman didn't get the nomination, and he's still being attacked by the DNC.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't matter.
Alberto Gonzalez, former U.S. Attorney General, Dean of the Belmont University School of Law in Nashville now, also the author of the book, most recently, True Faith and Allegiance. Alberto Gonzalez, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Go Bruins. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. As a lot of people listen to the show regularly know, I'm a bit of a parenting expert.
You have two hypothetical children, Dan Jr.
Two fictional children. Okay. I'm like George Foreman. I name all my children Dan.
Okay, so you have Dan Jr. 1, Dan Jr. 2.
Dan the 3rd.
And we have three children? Oh,
Dan Jr. and then Dan the 3rd.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
Yeah, they're all named Dan.
There's something I don't know.
Also, though, I dabble in relationships as well. Been doing some work in that space.
Yes.
Doing some work in that space.
So are you a marriage counselor or are you just
a relationship expert? You know, it's about making sure people get the best out of their relationships.
They bring the best out in each other?
Correct. It's the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. That's my approach to it.
As you know, my single friends right now to have them.
They should probably
listen to the segment.
So I was triggered by this piece at Real Clear Life. 17 women reveal the worst things you can say during an argument. And normally, if I get an argument, let me just give you an example of what I do, and then we'll bump it up against what the women say.
Okay.
All right. So what I'll say I get in an argument with somebody that I'm
with
dating,
a lady friend.
Right. So fictional. To like my children. I say, hey, look, calm down. I'm not listening to you. Your feelings are not important to me. And my ex, Jennifer, never caused me these problems. Does that strike you as a good way to approach?
Never tell anybody, first of all, to calm down.
All right. Hey, take it easy.
No.
Would you chill out?
No. No. First of all, no hands. You just cannot say any of that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Can you help Amy to learn how to diffuse tense situations, arguments between her and her...
lover.
Yeah, paramour. Yes.
So, and never, ever, ever bring up the ex. Ever compare who you're with now to the person that you used to
well,
be.
Well, like,
with.
So sometimes...
Even if that person is, you know, if you're a widow, that you don't bring that up.
What about if, like, a compliment like, you look so beautiful today, like my ex Jennifer, except you're a little bigger. Something like that?
Or she's wearing a tight t-shirt. You could say, you know, those do come in bigger sizes.
Yeah, something helpful, right?
Yeah.
So here's what some of the women... interviewed, including fellow relationship experts like myself, had to say. The big takeaways are don't say calm down.
Yeah, never. I think I've learned that with somebody that I know.
Don't
Dan.
Don't ignore them.
Oh, you mean this?
Let people feel their feelings.
Hey, I'm talking to you. Did you say something?
Yeah. Just prattling on. It's like the Charlie Brown. Yeah, I just don't even hear it. And then name calling, also a big no-no.
Oh, name calling?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, what? You know, maybe you'd have more energy to go to the show with me if you weren't such a fat ass. Something like that. I'm giving an example.
Why what Dan Proft is single?
What you don't do, I'm saying. Also, too, this was a surprise to me. One thing a guy should never do or say during a heated argument. One woman, Joanna, 36, marketing coordinator, said, "Don't punch things. Don't punch walls,
yeah.
Cars, doors, yourself, or your partner." Well, that's probably good advice. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because then you got a hot streak in them. I mean, you know that there's a hot streak. Excuse me.
Oh, take it easy. I want to be attentive to your needs over there.
I'm choking on water.
Oh, it's a dangerous substance. The best way to diffuse an argument. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Here's the one that I think is sort of a kindred spirit with me in terms of advice and counsel to improve your relationships out there. Christine, she's 69 years old. She's retired.
Yeah.
What I've learned is to simply shut up. I have learned that arguing is counterproductive, and while shutting up is very difficult for me, it serves the best purpose.
But then what do you do with that pent-up anger?
Yeah, you deal with it.
You go work out?
Not my problem.
Wow, you're a really good counselor. Yeah. Not my problem. Next!
Yeah, go deal with your issues. Jeez. It's your problem. The one thing never to say is, I don't know why you even bother to argue with me when you know I'm always right.
There you go.
I just think in my head, because like most women, I usually am right, says Christine. Never attack your, as I mentioned, another no-go. Grace, 25, a microbiologist. Never attack your partner with low blows about their insecurities or insensitivities. They trust you with those things, so to use them in an argument is a way to wound them really quickly.
Yeah, don't shove it back in their face.
But isn't that the whole point of arguing, is to wound people quickly to finish them off, because it's a fight, and the point of the fight is to win. Isn't that?
Another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Why do you even get an argument if you're not trying to win?
Well, you just try to explain your reasoning and your feelings for certain situations.
What if your reasoning and feelings are inferior to my reasoning and feelings? Why can't you just say that I won?
Well, sometimes people say, you're right. I understand your point of view. I understand where you're coming from.
That's not
good enough
for me.
But this is how I feel, and this is how I want things to go.
No, this isn't about feelings.
For women, it is about feelings.
And when you say, I understand what you're saying, you may have a point. That's not good enough. Oh. I want that scored. We have to keep score. And then we have to keep a log of all of our arguments to see who's won, so we can keep a record of it. And then we can go back. And it's like going back to remember like the 83 White Sox and Harold Baines' sacrifice fly that brought Juice Cruz in from third, and they won the AL title.
I remember it like it was yesterday.
It's like, oh, you remember. So that's like remembering argument. Remember, this is like that argument where you were wrong and you lost to me in June of 2005 over going to your cousin's wedding. It's fun that way. You know, it's a way to kind of bring a shared experience back. Uh-huh. And strengthen the relationship, don't you think?
I have a good friend whose husband's a litigator. Every argument, she doesn't stand a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't stand a chance.
But that's the sport of it.
Oh, yeah. It's a sport, right.
Here's another woman's her approach to this. Yeah. Melissa, 24, an attorney.
Oh, yeah.
Is she
a litigator, though?
I don't know. She says, when fighting with my husband, he knows that opting to leave me alone when I'm upset only makes me more upset.
Oh, ooh, she's one of those.
Sends the message, she doesn't care about my feelings, and that I'm alone in this argument, and then she prattles on about other stuff. I lost interest, like her husband.
I don't like those women.
So what,
I've lived with a few in a sorority like that.
What her husband has learned to do, he's been trained, he's adopted this key phrase, I want to take a time out on this conversation. Because it signals to her that what she has to say, I guess, is important. And the conversation's not over. We'll pick it back up later when we're both not, you know, behaving like children.
Okay.
What about that?
That's a very level-headed way.
Yeah. Also, another never that comes up a couple of times among these women, the never say during a heated argument, I told you so.
Oh, that's the worst.
Even worse than chill out or calm down.
Oh, I told you so. It's condescending, and it just stings a little. I would never say I told you so, but I told you so.
And then blaming each other, like it's all your fault. You always do this, talking in absolutes. It's all on you, or you always do this. This is also something women don't seem to like.
Yeah. It's all your fault. I had that for 12 years until somebody apologized to me recently.
Really?
Yeah.
Do tell.
Well, all right. My ex-husband finally apologized to me.
Really?
Yeah. What year is this?
This is 2018.
So what year did I get to for? Okay, so yeah, it's been about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
10 years, and he did something bad.
Did he say chill out 10 years ago?
Oh, chill out. And
I told you so.
I told you so, and all that. And he apologized to me. He said, I want you to know that I've been blaming you for the divorce for this whole time, and it was my fault.
Oh.
I'm like, oh.
Oh, good.
I didn't need him to tell me that, but. Like,
after a decade and a half of poisoning your children against you.
Yeah, exactly. I said, well, that's fine, and I appreciate the apology, but talk to Peyton and Eli about that, because I think they need to know, because they kind of throw that in my face. Mm-hmm. Well, Mom, if you weren't so demanding, Dad wouldn't have left, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, that's not really what happened, and I've never told them what happened, even though I really want to tell them what happened.
Yeah.
But so he told them, finally.
Hmm.
That it wasn't all my fault. Thanks.
If only I would have been there at the time to counsel you two through that rough patch. Now, Amy, I want you to turn to your partner and say, hey, in response to what you just said, I would like you to invite you to go make love to yourself. So that's a way to advance the conversation,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But room temperature, mm-hmm, always room temperature.
Abused you back then. Dan.
Here's another a little device that a couples consultant named Leslie Doors suggests. Be curious or confused. That's a great way to go if you're in an argument. That's the best way to deal with it. Tell me more about this, or I got lost here. Listening is always a good way to get somebody to chill. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then one more never. Emily Mendez, who's a mental health writer.
Oh.
Never try to purposely hurt your partner during an argument. Don't call them names, yell at them, or say spiteful things.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Don't throw or break things. Fine. Tony in Downers Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, here's the thing. Even if the argument is resolved, there's two things. One, you could say something to a woman and she could say, yes, I understand, or we're okay. And somehow by the time it resonates with her, it's interpreted differently. The other thing is there's a vault in the back of the mind,
yeah,
and they keep it there. Mm-hmm. Could be a year, could be a month, could be 5 years. The issue somehow comes back up, somehow out of nowhere, even if it was resolved. So the best thing to do is have an alternative option.
Such as leaving?
Are you talking about one of those Japanese dolls? What do you mean, an alternative option?
Not a blow-up doll. Have a real option.
Oh, you mean have a backup lady?
Oh.
Well, yeah. Backup ladies, always a good plan.
Wow.
Thanks for the call, Tony. I did not see that on the list of...
A backup babe? No, is that on the list there?
The best way to diffuse an argument with a partner, get a new partner. yeah. I didn't think of that. Neither did these 17 women who were interviewed for this piece. I don't think
that escalated quickly.
I don't think they were thinking about the nuclear option.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and Borat is at it again. The comedic actor Sacha Baron Cohen has a new show on Showtime.
Yeah, it's going to air this Sunday at 9 p.m.
And among the things that he did for this show is the thing that he has done in his previous shows, both as Da Ali G and then as Borat. He spoofed high-profile politicos. You remember Borat? Like, do you remember the Ron Paul scene in the hotel room?
Oh, remind me of that one.
So he's interviewing Ron Paul, and then they take a break, and a light went out, so he wants you to just relax in the next room. They're in a hotel room, so they go to the bedroom, and then Sacha Baron Cohen proceeds to essentially disrobe and proposition Ron Paul, who then leaves the room and says, okay, I'm done with this. This is crazy. I'm over. He interviewed Alan Keyes.
Oh, I remember that. He interviewed Barney Frank, and he offered him a cookie, and while Barney Frank was eating the cookie, he said, well, we make those cookies with my mother's breast milk.
Yes,
and
then right.
I just remember that.
Yeah, so there's that. And
then there's been controversy. I remember he was hitchhiking and got in a van with a bunch of kids from South Carolina, University of South Carolina.
Yeah.
And then one of those kids sued him because he made him look bad. And
so
thought they were being nice to a foreigner.
What normally happens, though, is you get release assigned. So you can be duped, but if you don't sign a release, then you have recourse. If you sign a release, then you don't. Sarah Palin, apparently was duped and did sign a release and then went public with it. She suggested that Sacha Baron Cohen essentially dressed up as a wounded veteran.
Yeah, he was in a wheelchair.
And began interviewing her about military-related issues in that character.
She's come forward, and she had a Facebook post yesterday afternoon because for the interview, my daughter and I were asked to travel across the country where Cohen, I presumed, was heavily disguised himself as a disabled U.S. veteran, fake wheelchair and all, out of respect for what I was led to believe would be a thoughtful discussion with someone who served in uniform. I sat through this long interview full of Hollywoodisms, disrespect, and sarcasm, but finally had enough and literally physically removed my mic and walked out, much to Cohen's chagrin. The disrespect of our U.S. military and middle-class Americans via Cohen's foreign commentaries under the guise of interview questions was perverse. He mocked those who I thought who have fought and served for our country. Honestly, that's and how she felt. And she said it was truly sick. And then to put, you know, salt in their wound, one of Cohen's people had taken them to the airport so they could fly back to Alaska, purposely drove to the wrong airport. So then they missed their flights to Alaska that evening.
Yeah.
So she's come out before this saying, you know, I want you to see the whole tape where I actually was so sick of being paraded like this that I got up, took my mic off, and left. But she doesn't think he'll put that in the show.
Oh, I'm sure he will. They air before people storming out of the room like Ron Paul did in Borat.
How did Ron Paul get duped into that? I mean,
this is accomplishing exactly what Sacha Baron Cohen wants it to, which is to give great press and profile in advance of the airing of his show because of these high profile politicos. Dick Cheney is in the trailer as well. He's profiled in the trailer signing a water bottle.
Yeah.
Or, water jug, right.
Right, because of waterboarding.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that.
And also, turns
someone
out...
Someone we know.
This from Entertainment Weekly, Joe Walsh.
Our Joe Walsh?
Yeah, show on this station, says that Sacha Baron Cohen duped him, too. And he calls for a boycott of Showtime and Borat's new show.
I'm not boycotting Showtime.
He's a comedian. He can be funny, but mocking a disabled veteran to spoof Sarah Palin is a serious matter. He goes on to tell, to describe what he encountered. We started talking pro-Israel stuff, Israeli defense, and then out of left field, the interviewer starts talking about how children should defend themselves against terrorist attacks. I understand Israel handles security very differently than how America handles security. Interviewed showed several articles involving children stopping terrorists, stuff like that. They had me read off a teleprompter. I stopped and questioned their direction. And just like that, producers rushed me out of the studio as an apparent fight broke out. Strangest interview of my life. Don't think they spoofed me very much.
Well, wait, a fight broke out?
I'm just reading what he posted. So what about that? You're going to boycott Sacha Baron Cohen show, you're going to boycott Showtime. You have sympathy for politicos who get spoofed by a comedic actor like a Borat. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I just want to know if they paid people for this interview. Did, you know, former Vice President Dick Cheney, that's just weird that a man of his intelligence level and the people that he should be having around him to protect him, let him sit down for that interview.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, have you met Dick Cheney? He's a scary dude, which is good. I wanted to, you know, you need.
I think he's a scary dude.
When I met him, he commands a level of respect and he's earned it and he deserves it. That's why I'm so surprised he sat down. And Sarah Palin, you think that they would know better too. And did they pay for their own flights to go from Anchorage to D.C. to do these interviews?
Dressing up, Walsh said, dressing up as a wounded veteran is absolutely stolen valor. His tactics are disgusting.
Is it stolen valor?
No.
But you're passing yourself off as a wounded veteran.
Not for purposes of personal enrichment or aggrandizement.
But it's a show. I mean, he's making money off of the show, selling himself, passing himself off as a disabled veteran. Should Sacha Baron Cohen be arrested? 312-642-5600.
Do you think in the show that people are going to understand him to be a veteran or understand him to be spoofing politicians like they like he did in Borat? Which do you think? High
branch of service he alleged to belong to.
I got to tell you, the high dudgeon from people who were hornswoggled like Palin and Walsh is not particularly compelling to me. It's just not particularly compelling. You got spoofed. You signed a release you shouldn't have released. Didn't vet somebody that you should have properly vetted. Probably so solicitous of being interviewed you were. So is that particularly, am I real concerned about that? No. No, I'm not. Nick in Barrington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. Sacha Cohen is no different than a terrorist. He goes after soft targets. He knows he's not going to be confronted by people where he pulls these nasty stunts. You could see it basically from his first movie, Borat, where, you know, he goes after people that are generally nice people, essentially flyover country, if you will. And it's a shame that he's allowed to get away with it. Hopefully one day he'll be confronted by someone that will kick his butt, frankly, for pulling the stunts that he does.
Yeah, okay, well, that's fine. You cannot like it. Thanks for the call, Nick. He's not a terrorist. That's absurd. No different than a terrorist? That's an absurd statement. That's ridiculous. You cannot like, I mean, just like...
He's a comedian. He thinks he's a comedian.
When Jay Leno did jaywalking, and then he would interview idiots on the street who didn't know how many branches of government that we have. Is Jay Leno a terrorist, too? I mean, I understand what you're saying about preying on people, and then also, in this case, but much like these produced segments for late-night TV shows, casting people in the worst possible light. But that's not terrorism. It may be lowbrow humor, but then don't go on camera. You know, have a spidey sense that tingles. Sean in Elmwood Park.
If he was doing this to Daly down at the Stray Dog in Michigan, hanging off a bar stool with vomit on his shirt, we'd be loving it.
Yeah,
it's that we don't like who he targeted. Because here's the real issue, and I have zero sympathy for the people who are so-called targeted, because what they want to do is just promote themselves. They want to sell their virtue. They want to sell their expertise. That's what they're doing. And here's a little lesson. Be suspicious of everybody. I love, you know, I have a little... I have a little cigar business, Prof, that you know, where you rarely pay your tab.
That's right.
In that cigar business, I get a lot of hucksters. These morphodites come in with their pad, and they're selling energy. I love it when they come in, because I like to watch them walk, run out of there like your dog does with his tail between his legs. I enjoy when people try to get one over on me. I welcome it. Be suspicious. Although we hear a name and we think, oh, it's going to be great. They're going to be wonderful. What this guy exposes is that these politicians are morons. They know nothing, nothing, and they're easily duped. And what do you think we're going to do? We give them our checkbook. Go ahead, now write the checks for the people. It's ridiculous.
Thanks, Sean.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. AM560 The Answer.
Dan and Amy are talking about that new Sacha Baron Cohen show that airs on Showtime this weekend, where he has spoofed Sarah Palin and duped Sarah Palin.
Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney, apparently, per the trailer for the show.
Oh, yeah.
And
sitting down in a wingtip chair.
What?
Yeah, he was sitting
down. Wing back.
Wing back, but we call it wingtip chair. But oh boy,
wingtip chair.
Don't you have one in your house?
I have wingtip shoes. I have wing back chairs.
Okay, fine. My great grandma told me it was something different. Thanks, Nana.
Liar. That's what she is.
Hey, she's a wet nurse. Leave her alone.
And
hey.
Oh, really?
Well, among other things, ghostwriter. She survived. She was a survivalist and a Kappa Kappa Gamma house mom at Denison.
That's very impressive. Denison's a good school. There used to be. It's not too many good schools left.
No, that hasn't made the list yet. Denison has not done anything wrong. Their students have not rebelled against the establishment yet.
Yeah, I don't think no, I can't remember it's a story not on my from list. Denison. They've done a good job of keeping it all very quiet. Yeah. In honor of your Nana. But also Joe Walsh calling for a boycott of the show because he was also duped. Robert in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, kids. How about fair and balanced? Let's do Bill Clinton and have him walk in a room with an 18-year-old, legal age, have her undressed. I guarantee that's going to turn into an X-rated movie.
That nobody wants to see. Yes, thanks for the call, Robert.
He's too
Appreciate
busy
it.
Sitting in first class on a commercial flight somewhere. What airline was that, by the way?
Delta, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. With respect to, you know, kind of what about like the left, like, oh, we should do this to the... Okay, we should. So this is the conversation we have with Andrew Klavan from Jams Me, the Hollywood screenwriter, all the time. Yeah, right. We complain because the left has Borat to target conservative politicians to make arses out of some conservative politicians, as he continues to do. I don't know why people don't catch on. Colbert did the same thing on his show on Comedy Central for a time, although he was more... across the board. Remember his Get to Know a Congressman?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yes,
then the series. And I don't know why people sat down for these interviews because they always came off looking like idiots. Of course, that was the whole point of the interviewer, was to accomplish that. But the complaining about what the left does in media, I just am not particularly persuaded by, because as Klavan says, it's been a failure of conservatives to not build infrastructure. A failure of conservatives to not build infrastructure. We have talented writers and people that are funny and people that with money that can produce films and TV shows and the like. And you see some of that, of course. There's some very good movies in sort of the Christian space that have been produced, particularly in the last few years. Mel Gibson's wildly successful movie about the crucifixion as well. But we haven't built the infrastructure. Now, compare that to the Federalist Society. Compare that to what the Federalist Society has done in 35 short years in terms of putting together programming that attracted law students, that engaged them in debate. These are law students that went on to write on their law reviews or edit their law reviews to be successful in private practice, to be successful in politics, to be successful on the bench. And you built a cadre of professional individuals who excel in the legal arena. And that produces a Gorsuch and a Kavanaugh and so many others that were qualified, if not spectacular, potential jurists and existing jurists, but potential high court, Supreme Court justices. On that list that Trump has been selecting from. Building infrastructure, not getting caught up in personality. That's how you build a successful organization anywhere. It's the reason the Illinois Republican Party is the worst Republican Party organization at the state level in the country. Because it's just a kind of fleeting personalities. There's no infrastructure build. It's the reason why we don't have as much bandwidth in entertainment and culture as we could have, because we haven't invested the time, money, and energy to build infrastructure that extends beyond any individual personality. That's what the Federalist Society did. That should be the model, and it should be a model that we bring to the world of entertainment as well.
Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer, the one, the only.
Trump delivers a dog's breakfast to Angela Merkel while John Kelly looks for some scrambled eggs and bacon.
Jed Babin will be here at 8:08.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, Trump just arriving in Britain after lighting up Angela Merkel and some of our NATO allies yesterday in Brussels. By the way, please do, Amy, keep us updated on Stormy Daniels' situation when she is released from prison.
I will let you know. Charged with a misdemeanor.
Yeah, yes. Very concerned about that. National
Her mugshot's out, by the way.
Yeah, no, it's lovely.
It is lovely.
Very
it's
tasteful.
One of the best mugshots.
Kudos to the police the department and whatever community she was in Ohio.
It's Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, great photography. Well, sure, they've got a lot of experience doing mugshots for Ohio State football players.
Right, and all the
so,
athletes.
Yeah, there. Right. Trump, among other things, went off at breakfast while General Kelly was looking for an omelet about Germany and this pipeline deal with the Russians.
When Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia, where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia. So we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting all of these countries. And then numerous of the countries go out and make a pipeline deal with Russia, where they're paying billions of dollars into the coffers of Russia. So we're supposed to protect you against Russia, but they're paying billions of dollars to Russia, and I think that's very inappropriate. And the former chancellor of Germany is the head of the pipeline company that's supplying the gas.
And Senator Chuck Grassley, part of a Senate that sort of rebuked Trump's trade policy with a resolution yesterday, he generally liked what Trump said, if not necessarily how he said it in Brussels.
This president's following through with something that he said during the campaign, something he said last year at the same meeting. And so I think now that it ought to be sinking in that he means business. And it's also sinking in from the fact that at least every country to a lesser and thank God a few countries to a greater degree are increasing their spending on NATO. But I think the most important thing that he brings up, if NATO is to protect from Russia's advancement westward, then quite frankly, why are you helping the economy and helping Putin by buying natural gas from him? Yes. I think that's a stronger point.
I think that is a strong point. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jed Babin, former U.S. Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, contributor to The Washington Times and The American Spectator. Jed, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. Good morning.
Good morning. We'll keep you updated. We may have to break in if Stormy Daniels is released from prison.
I know. That's much more important than anything going on in national security.
That is correct. So what about Trump making the pipeline deal between the Germans and the Russians a real sticking point yesterday?
Well, he's right. The Russians send about 20% of Germany's gas via one pipeline called Nord Stream 1. They're about to double that with a second pipeline called Nord Stream 2. And the Germans are sending a lot of money to Russia for that, and they're becoming dependent on Russia for their gas.
But why is that our business?
Well, it's our business because Russia, as the president said, we're trying to protect NATO from Russia, and our so-called NATO allies are filling Russia's coffers and buying natural gas from them. They're also, by the way, running a huge trade deficit with Iran. The Germans run a multi-billion euro trade deficit with Iran. Lord only knows what they're importing from there, but it's almost assuredly oil. So you have the biggest enemies that we have, not including China, being supported substantially by Germany, for one, and several other NATO countries. It's just the wrong thing for them to be doing. And all of this talk by Senator Grassley that the NATO countries are increasing their defense spending, hogwash. It ain't happening. It's not going to happen for at least 6 or 7 years, and that won't even happen then.
Yeah, and so then you layer on the fact that we're subsidizing their supposed contributions to the common defense. By the way, a common defense that Germany really isn't prepared to contribute much to. David French had a good piece on this, too. We're not talking when Trump insinuates that Germany is too weak to participate in NATO's common defense, the German military. He's not talking about returning Germany to World War II military levels, but he is talking about things like, and French points this out in his piece in National Review, Germany's Tornado fighters jets not able to participate in NATO missions due to technological deficiencies and just the capacity Germany has, in addition to its complicity with the Russians on that energy deal?
Well, French ignores the principal problem. The German army is unionized, for heaven's sake.
Okay.
They had to pull out of a NATO exercise last year because their troops exceeded their allowed overtime hours. I mean, you just can't do this. You can't have a serious military at all if you're going to be pulling out because their overtime has been exceeded. I mean, come on, guys. This is not even realistic. So, yeah, okay. The German planes can't. Look, the German army couldn't put down a decent-sized riot in L.A. at this point.
Well, right.
I'm not in favor of rearming Germany, but that's above my pay grade. That was decided by Harry Truman and Winston Churchill right after World War II because the Soviet Union was a big threat. Well, you know, Russia is still a big threat, and Germany needs to pick up its end of the stick.
There you go.
One of the reasons by President Trump scolded other NATO members is to have them pay up. He's sick of paying the bill. And there was a movement made because now our NATO allies are going to be increasing their defense spending. Do they need to even up it more?
Well, I mean, Amy, I don't think they're going to increase their defense spending. They keep talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, but they don't do it. Germany was saying, oh, well, we're going to increase our defense spending significantly this year. Well, they didn't. And the French are saying, well, we're not going up to 4%, monsieur. We're going to smoke instead. We're going to enjoy our gavois.
It's a great French accent.
Just isn't I can mock the French better than anybody. Hey, I'm the first guy to ever say when we were going to war in Iraq, going to war without France is like going deer hunting without an accordion. You just leave a lot of noisy, useless baggage behind. That was me. You can look it up.
That's a good line. I like that.
No, thank you. At the risk of being serious, you know, the French and the Germans, the Spanish, the Italians, I mean, all of these countries that we're supposed to be protecting, they're not helping us. One of the ideas of NATO was that we would provide a core defense posture, a presence in Europe, around which they would form their own strong militaries. They haven't done it for 60 years. So what are we supposed to do? We can't get them to pay us to defend them. You know, they won't do that. I mean, they're sovereign nations, and you know, they're responsible for their own defense, but they're not going to do it themselves either. So we have to put a lot of pressure on them. Trump is doing the right thing. I don't know if he's doing it the right way, but, you know, that's Trump.
Yeah, and I mean, the polite way hasn't seemed to work, as you pointed out, so maybe a little bit more aggressive shaming, even as John Kelly is upset about the role selection at breakfast. Is the way to go. The question is, though, should he just keep sort of rhetorically beating them up on this, or should the U.S. consider pulling out of NATO?
Well, I think pulling out of NATO would be a terrible idea. I don't think the president wants to do that. He said this morning he wasn't going to do that, although he could. Frankly, he can't. NATO is a treaty. It was ratified by the Senate. And the president can't pull out of NATO just by himself.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is we have to get them, you know, by continued diplomatic pressure, by presidential rhetoric, we have to keep pounding on those guys to say, you guys are not holding your end of the deal up, and you've got to do it better. So we'll see what happens. I frankly am not at all optimistic about it because I just don't think they're going to do it.
What do you hope? President Trump landing this morning in London is going to be meeting tomorrow with Queen Elizabeth, and then he's off.
That's an important meeting.
That's going to be.
Yeah.
Then he's off to Russia. What do you think he and hopes to accomplish with Putin?
Well, I don't know. He is certainly not agreeing, as he said this morning, to Russia's possession of Crimea. I think he wants to talk about Syria and having Iran withdraw from Syria, which frankly isn't going to happen. But I don't know what he's planning on beyond that. It's very troubling to me that the president has not taken a stronger stand against Putin and Russia, not only with respect to the business of the interference in the 2016 election, but all of the other things that Russia is doing. And Russia is highly active, trying to destabilize pretty much anywhere in the world that they can reach. And, you know, they need to be brought back to reality a little bit, and I don't think the president's going to even try.
Well, you're looking for a Reagan moment from Trump with respect to Putin. I mean, it's just this whole pipeline deal with Germany and Russia reminds of the 1982, exploding the pipeline that Maggie Thatcher wanted from Russia to Eastern Europe, to Western Europe, that President Reagan was opposed to because he wanted to punish the Soviet Union for their oppressive tactics in Poland. So does Trump need something like that?
He won't get it. I don't think he'll even try for it because, you know, frankly, he's not Reagan. Trump's a pretty good president, but he's not. He does not have the vision and certainly does not have the ideology to propel him to do anything like that. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, were he to challenge the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, I think it would simply fail. I don't think that there's any way he can stop it. So I think at this point, to look for anything in Helsinki a lot better than we've seen before is unrealistic.
All right. Hopefully he takes at least a little bit tougher tack with Putin than Megyn Kelly did. That's my threshold clear.
No, I think you're right. I mean, he needs to take a very tough approach to Putin. And one of the continuing mysteries of his presidency is why he has not taken a stronger stand, called Putin out personally, you know, talked about the fact that they aggressively, well, through aggression, they took over the Crimea. They're still at war in Ukraine.
Right.
And, you know, they really should not be doing what they're doing. Again,
right, but President Obama, but President Obama, you know, allowed Russians to annex Crimea. He didn't do anything.
I think that's on him. That's on Obama. But I don't think that Trump needs to make it easy for them by doing anything else. I think he's doing the right thing. We've been sending arms to Ukraine. I think we do need to do a lot more of that. And I think he needs to take the opportunity to criticize what Putin is doing in Syria, in Ukraine, and a lot of other areas at this summit meeting. You know, he needs to be tough with Putin, and so far he's not been.
What did you take from Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin upon his return from a trip to Russia, talking about the need to focus on more targeted sanctions against oligarchs in the Putin inner circle as the best way to put pressure on the regime?
Well, it's one way to put pressure on the regime. It's a small way to put pressure on the regime. You know, I like Ron Johnson, but, you know, anytime something comes out of the House or the Senate, any mouth over there, I kind of sit back and yawn. So the fact of the matter is he is not deciding things. And I think the president needs to be much more critical of Russia and its movements around the world. And I think that's the way we can get back to some sort of better policy towards Russia. Because frankly, right now, I don't think we have one. There's a lot of places in this world that are hotting up that we do not have a policy to redress.
He is Jed Babin, former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, now a contributor to The Washington Times and The American Spectator. Jed, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer. See Sean Spicer in Chicago on August 8th. Tickets are absolutely free. Get yours at 560theanswer.com/briefing.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'll tell you what, when the most pointed and specific critiques of a Republican president's nominee to the Supreme Court are coming from conservative talk show hosts like Mark Levin, you're probably in a pretty good place, as well as with a lot of conservatives still backing them. But all the left has to offer, like these Yale law students and alumni and professors, are just kind of screeching generically about Brett Kavanaugh being the end of the world, the end of life in America as we know it. That's not going to be enough. And otherwise, this guy presents as a Boy Scout.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's very philanthropic, and I know that he sold that, you know, to the American people when he was introducing himself on Monday night, but he's a man of his word. I mean, yesterday he was caught, are you ready for this? Feeding the homeless hot meals.
Yeah.
Ooh. But that's something that he had scheduled to do long before he became the Supreme Court Justice nominee.
So far, you've got, let's see, he spent a lot of money on Washington Nationals tickets that his friends later reimbursed him for. And
he put home improvements on his credit card, which he paid.
Yeah, he got get to the home improvements. But what were those home improvements?
Yeah.
A secret line to Putin, maybe. and then you got 20 years ago, he was at some State of the Union watch party with Laura Ingraham, or at Laura Ingraham's place, and he allegedly mouthed the word "bitch" to describe Hillary Clinton when she came on screen.
I thought that he said he's got an itch. I don't know.
Sure. That doesn't seem like that's going to be enough to topple this nomination, but what do I know? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the managing editor for the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. He is Philip Klein. Philip Klein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, the combination of, it seems like, a very kind of thin oppo file on Kavanaugh, combined with some red state Democrats who are down in the polls right now, Heitkamp, Nelson, and Donnelly. Do you see, other than a lot of histrionics, any real trouble for Kavanaugh getting confirmed?
No, at this stage, it's hard to see that he has problems. Right now, I mean, obviously, given the thinness of the Republican majority, and the Democrats' sort of posture of total resistance, you could never say anything's guaranteed. However, it strikes me that Kavanaugh has been in the Washington legal scene. He's been an insider for decades. He's a very well known. He has been a federal judge for a dozen years. He has. He was added quite conspicuously to the Supreme Court list put out by Trump last November. And when he was added, a lot of people thought, okay, well, if he's adding him, that suggests he might be the pick, or at least high on the short list. And so Democrats who have a lot of money and liberal groups who are dedicated to defeating conservative judges have had 8 months to dig up anything they could on Kavanaugh. And typically, a nominee, you want to badger them right out of the gate as sort of unacceptable. I mean, if you remember the initial Borking of Robert Bork, right after his nomination, Ted Kennedy came out and sort of talked about Robert Bork's America, and it was kind of a nonstop barrage. And so it's very unlikely that they have anything big on him that's going to tank them. And if you look at the Republican centrists, their language has been very positive. Collins of Maine, who's one of the potential no votes, was very effusive about his experience and thought a lot of the Democratic attacks were overblown and so forth. So I'd be surprised at this point if he didn't go down, if he weren't confirmed. But, you know, again, that given the thinness of the majority, there's always that question mark.
Well, what's going to be the centerpiece for the Democrats' line of attack? Is it going to be a decision that he made on Obamacare?
It seems like right now they're talking about this other Obamacare suit. Right now there's this suit coming that's in Texas right now, where about 20 states got together, and they're basically... It's another legal challenge saying Obamacare has to be overturned. And the Trump administration said that they're not defending Obamacare, and that they think that the pre-existing condition regulations are now unconstitutional. And we could go into the legal arguments if you want, but the bottom line is that this is a very long shot case. It's at the district court, lower court level. It hasn't even been argued yet. And Democrats are trying to hinge onto that to say that if Kavanaugh is is the nominee, then he's going to get rid of pre-existing conditions. And it's just like a very, it's a huge stretch. And the you know, the fact that they're stretching this far makes me wonder, well, do they really have anything? And then, you know, my suspicions that they have nothing on him were only reconfirmed with the great Washington Post expose on the fact that he bought Nationals tickets on a credit card that were later reimbursed by friends who put the tickets with.
That's a real story of international intrigue. Here's the thing. So the Obamacare thing, it seems to me, is the second prong of the two-prong hysteria that's proffered by Democrats. Chuck Schumer sort of telegraphed it earlier in the week. The first is going to be, of course, overturning Roe v. Wade. And this is particularly important for Democrats, it would seem. Some polling that came out this week that suggests the enthusiasm to vote in the midterms among women, where Democrats have electoral advantage, isn't sort of where it needs to be for Democrats to be successful in November. And this may be the path they see to energizing that cohort of the electorate.
Yes, but the problem that they face is that in order to take over the Senate, there are, because the Senate seats that are up this year are the ones that Democrats won in 2012 when it was a good year for Democrats when President Obama was reelected.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the states that there are basically about eight states that are considered toss-ups. And Democrats have to win seven of those eight states in order to gain control of the Senate. They have to virtually run the table. And most of those states are states that are red states that Trump won, and by wide margins. So you have, for instance, Missouri, West Virginia, North Dakota, and Indiana, all states that were heavily Trump. And they all have Democrats who are running for re-election. So if they actually do vote down this nominee, then it actually puts in danger their ability to retake the Senate, and they could actually end up losing Senate seats.
Well, that's
so
it.
So there's this sort of tension, because if they actually are successful in defeating the nomination, then it actually could prevent them from winning the Senate, even as it may help them in certain districts on the House side.
Well, that's what, that started out talking about Donnelly, Kuykendall, and Nelson being down in the polls right now. And of course, there are other opportunities for Republican pickups in places like West Virginia and Montana. And it just seems to me highly unlikely that a Heitkamp or a Donnelly or a Nelson would want to seal their fate on what appears to be a quixotic vote against confirming Kavanaugh.
Well, keep in mind that Manchin and Donnelly and Heitkamp already voted for Gorsuch.
Yeah, right.
Right.
So it seems to me, I think the difficulty that they're going to have is if Republicans, like if Collins and Murkowski somehow vote no, and then the nomination, then Republicans need Democrats to put the nomination over the top. That's going to be a more difficult vote for them than a situation in which Republicans are aligned, the nomination's going through. At that point, it almost becomes a pre-vote to just say, you know, I'm an independent of my party and I voted yes for Trump's Supreme Court nominee.
Do you know how soon we can get the confirmation hearings can get started?
I don't know, because this was one of the reasons why McConnell was cautious about causing Trump about Kavanaugh, is that because he has such a long record dating back to his days when he was a lawyer in Ken Starr's investigation of President Clinton and working in the Bush White House and 12 years on the appellate court, he has a very long paper trail. So what Democrats are going to try to do to delay the nomination is they're going to request all sorts of documents from dating back to his days in the Bush White House, dating back to the Ken Starr investigation. So you basically have over 20 years of document requests. And so the hope is that the way the Democrats do it is that they wait for the documents. They say that, well, we have to have these documents so we could vet the nominee. And if Republicans don't release them, they're going to say they're stonewalling. What are they hiding? They're not being transparent. And then if they do release everything, then it's going to delay any vote on months and months. And Republicans want to have him confirmed by October 1st so that he could sit on the court for the next session, and so that it doesn't take, so that he's in place before the November election, so that they don't risk losing the Senate and then not being able to confirm him.
Yeah,
so,
they can just, look, Republicans can just say, look, confirm him to see what's in those files. And yeah, that should satisfy Nancy Pelosi.
My guess is that they'll release a certain number of files so that they can defang Democratic attacks by saying, look, you know, by having a huge stack or something. We've released, you know, 100,000 files, and, you know, the Democrats have had, and
right,
they've had months to look at them, and now it's time to vote, right? So they're not, I think that at some point they're going to cut it off, because Democrats are, you know, could endlessly ask for different documents and so forth.
We'll produce all the documents when Rod Rosenstein does. Philip Klein, managing editor for the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. His latest column is on Democrats' focus on Obamacare as it pertains to Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Philip, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show more Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.